Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, sweetheart. I want to tell you that as foggy and as rainy as you think London Town is, you ought to be where I am right now. So we have something in common, finally, other than this this radio show. Good morning, everybody. Welcome from the friendly confines of my rented house overlooking the first green on the golf course at Beach Mountain, North Carolina, where it has rained nice. Consistently for the last 48 hours. And I'm on vacation, okay, to play golf. So I haven't even seen – the only thing I've seen of the course is the green that's out my front door. So once you know I'm having a great – I bet I'm having a good vacation. Maryland's here. My son is here. I'm having a good time. But, I mean, it's not quite what I thought it was going to be. All right, so we'll leave it at that. My name is Jeffrey Schwartz. I am a professor of law. I still am, right? Yeah, a professor of law at Cooley Law School for Tampa Bay campus. And I'm here with my compatriot, Brendan Deary, who is also, just by happenstance, and I always say it's a day-to-day thing, a professor of law at Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus. And good morning, Brendan.
Oh, good morning, Jeffrey. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm glad that we were able to solve our technical issues.
Yeah.
Brendan was having this tough time getting through to Hezzy. Hi, Hezzy.
Good morning.
Hezzy? Okay, there you are.
Yes, sir.
He put us on mute. He put us on mute and he had to push the button again. It's sort of like what you do, Brendan.
Yeah.
Okay. I can't put it on mute today because I cut you off too.
Yeah, that's right.
I control you today.
And what else is new?
What else is happening? Yes. So yeah, no, it's been wonderful. I came up here to look at the birds, and the birds are all hiding from the rain. We put the bird feeders out. They haven't been anywhere near them. Everything is just working out exactly as I planned it. But I do have 12 more days, okay? I got 12
nice.
More days.
There you go.
Something good will happen. I'm sure good will happen.
Go.
This is the Constitution today and everything else that we want to talk about. Before we commence, I have to tell you that the opinions and the things that are said by Brendan and myself are our opinions and our opinions alone, and I say our because we agree on so many different things, that are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of Cooley Law School, its faculty, either at large or individually. So we've solved that problem.
There you go.
So how's your day going, Bren?
Oh, God. Let's see. My refrigerator is broken again. I got stung by a wasp yesterday and then tripped and fell when I was running away from the wasp nest and bruised myself. Anything else you want? Are you glad you asked?
Yeah. It's okay. This is our show. We can hear whatever grievances we have. Okay. If you don't like wasps, that's okay.
Well, wasps don't like me. That was their last mistake, though. I've been leaving that nest alone because they haven't bothered me. But yesterday, one of them flew around and stung me in the back, and so now they're all going to have to die. You know what can you say?
You know, don't feel bad about that because Marilyn had these wasps that were trying to build a nest on an overhang of one of her windows.
Yeah.
And there was a queen there, and there were three workers, and they would disappear at night. It's like, you know, I'm building a nest, but I'm going to go back home.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Live in my mother's basement until I'm ready to move into my own apartment. Okay.
Right. Right.
And we just kept spraying that thing and knocking it down, and they kept coming back and starting all
really?
Over again. Yeah. Oh yeah, they're stubborn little things, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So finally they went away. Finally they got the hint that we didn't sublet.
Right.
So it's okay. Okay, so there's all kinds of things. Oh, by the way, my commiserations to all of our New York fans. I happen to be a Yankee fan. I don't like them being in last place, and they are god-awful. They lost to the White Sox last night. I mean, they are just – even Gerrit Cole can't win a game. They are just god-awful. They can't hit. They can't pitch. Their defense is decent, but when the other team's hitting line drives, it's pretty hard to be, you know, do anything defensively. So I'm not impressed. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, they split with Houston over the weekend, and then they now lost to the White Sox, and I'm not holding a whole lot of hope. They're actually a half a game behind the Red Sox. That hurts more than anything else. They could finish fourth as long as the Red Sox are behind them. I don't care. So be that as it may, my commiserations to everyone anywhere in the northern areas of New York City, you know, the Bronx and that area, Westchester and that area, we're all Yankee fans.
Mm-hmm.
So go Yankees, okay? They're just not very good right now, bottom line. There's a lot of stuff going on. And Brendan and I, as always, in our conspiratorial way, meet Tuesday mornings by telephone to figure out what we're going to talk about, so there aren't very many surprises other than when, you know, I see a headline come across while the computer in front of me. There's a lot to talk about. I really don't want to start with Donald and Aileen Cannon and all of that. There's some important other stuff to talk about, but we will talk about those other issues. I want to start today, as long as Brendan agrees, with a discussion of what's happening in my home state of Ohio today. There is a special election that was called by the legislature based upon a constitutional provision that they want adopted that would raise the ability of the public to amend the Constitution of the state of Ohio to require a 60-vote majority, a supermajority, as opposed to a simple 50% plus one vote. And this would not have been raised except for in November in the general election. There is a proposal that they got like three times as many signatures as they needed for them to put it on the ballot, to amend the Ohio Constitution to enshrine the Roe v. Wade decision and the guidelines of Roe v. Wade for purposes of women terminating their pregnancies. And Republicans in the legislature didn't like that because that proposal was in direct response to the incredibly abusive law that was passed by the legislature that basically wiped out abortion in the state of Ohio, even though close to 60% of the people in Ohio opposed that law. That law resulted in a 10-year-old child who had been impregnated by her uncle to either complete the pregnancy and give birth to a child at the age of 11 or go out of state to terminate the pregnancy. And the child would have been basically, according to the laws of the state of Ohio, incestuous. She is a child of 10 years old. And their law required that she go through a pregnancy and give birth when she would have been 11 years old. The outrage within the people of the state of Ohio was palpable to the extent that it spread across the country. And even some, not all, but not the most rabid ones, but some anti-abortionists said, this is child abuse for the state to do this. The state is committing the child abuse. So they went out and they got all these petitions signed, and they got it on the ballot to restore Roe v. Wade and enshrine it in the state constitution. And Republicans claim that what's happening is today there is a proxy vote on that proposal because all the polls show 58% to 60% of the voting public in Ohio are going to come out and vote for the amendment to enshrine Roe v. Wade. And so Republicans put this thing on the ballot to try to short-circuit that vote in hopes that they could just keep it under 60% so it doesn't matter what the majority wants, the minority controls.
Right.
And that's what they're trying to do. The turnout has been amazing even up to this point. Over 550,000 people had voted before the polls opened this morning by absentee ballots. The turnout is going to be huge for a special election. And I think Republicans know they're going to lose. And that does not bode well, obviously, for November. That means that the pro-choice amendments will pass. It will be part of the Ohio Constitution. Forbids the legislature from in any way, shape, or form passing any bill that restricts the right to women's health care and to termination of pregnancy. And it doesn't bode well for the reelection of a Republican legislature. And so it's kind of important because as of right now, anti-abortion, pro-life people are feeling the pain of what voters think. They control legislatures, but voters control other things, and they've lost every single vote that's been put to a statewide referendum up to this point. So that's what's happening in Ohio today, and keep your eyes on it, because the vote could be north of 60% against what the legislature proposed, and I would not want to be a Republican legislator running for reelection next year. Mm-hmm. I just wouldn't. Mm-hmm. But what do you think, Brendan?
Yeah, a couple things. Number one is if Democrats don't have the abortion issue on the ballot in every state where it's possible to get it on the ballot, then that would be political malpractice. I'm talking about, of course, the election next year. It brings to mind what Republicans did. I'm sure both of you remember when George W. Bush was running for re-election. Republicans capitalized politically on the anti-gay sentiment that was at that time rampant in the country, and put gay same-sex marriage bans on the ballot in every state where they could, just to drive out the conservative vote, and it worked. And liberals have to learn from that and do the same thing, because right now the energy is on their side. In a big way, and probably a bigger way than ever when it comes to quote-unquote culture wars. So that's one thing, is that Democrats really need to do that. The other thing that came to mind when you were talking about it, you know, how they want to enshrine minority rule in Ohio by requiring a 60% threshold to amend the Constitution. What came to mind is that appears to be the entire Republican project anymore, is minority rule. They have lost any interest in appealing to people who are rational and centrist. Instead, they just want to rig the system so that even though they are a small minority, they're still in control. And I talk about this stuff all the time. Some of our system is rigged in their favor to begin with. So, for example, the U.S. Senate, with two senators for every state, no matter how big the state or what the population of the state, leads to gross overrepresentation of sparsely populated states, which tend to be extremely Republican and rural. And so the fact that the Senate is composed that way means that Republicans have a lot of control, even though they're a minority politically. The Electoral mm-hmm. College can have the same impact as we've seen. Now, twice since 2000, the candidate who lost the popular vote won the Electoral College. So despite the fact that the majority of Americans wanted Hillary Clinton and Al Gore to be president in those two elections, we wound up with George W. Bush and Donald Trump. Arguably, by the way, two of the worst presidents in all of American history, let alone our lifetimes. And that was not the will of the majority. Then we have gerrymandering, which is not a both sides do it issue. It's far more pervasive on the Republican side, but to gerrymander districts so that even if Republicans are 40% of the population of the state, they control the state legislature and they control congressional seats. Then we have all the voting restrictions, right? No more voting on the Sunday before election day. All kinds of voter ID, all kinds of voting restrictions, and this just kind of fits, right? They know they're going to lose, so instead of changing their policy position and trying to reach some kind of a reasonable, rational solution to the abortion issue in Ohio, they instead try to change the rules. It's a very Republican thing to do. I don't know, as you were talking about that, you know, that vote today, all of that is coming to mind. Let alone, you know, January 6th and the authoritarian impulse to install Donald Trump as president for life and all that nonsense. Even beyond all that, it really is the anti-democratic party, small d. This is a group mm-hmm. that has no use for democracy, has no use for majority rule. The only thing they care about is keeping power and imposing their will.
And let's not avoid, you know, the elephant in the room. The reason why they are this way is because of let's put it this way, and I'm one of the few people who speak this out loud, and that is that Barack Obama was a good president. He wasn't a great president. He was a good president. He was a good caretaker. He was very careful in what he did. But the truth, because he did not want to do anything outrageous that would raise race to basically define him. The problem mm-hmm. is that he, in my opinion, was in too much of a hurry. And he was not a candidate in 2008. And his election unleashed an anger and disaffected white Americans who believe that they are being outbursted and soon to become a minority in this country, and they can't stop it. They're trying, but it's like trying to stop, evolution. But this is what this is all about, and I truly believe that a lot of what we are living through today is as a result of the 2008 election. And I don't think he would have won, but for the financial disaster that took place in 2007 and 2008. Absent that, I don't think that he would have won. But he did. And I think that it was only a matter of not even his reelection in 2012, because I think a lot of people thought that that was going to happen. But the need for white Americans to believe that they needed to surface, to fight, to do everything they could, caused them to co-opt what was at least a patriotic, if not right on the societal issues. They were at least patriotic party, the Republican Party, and they co-opted it. And 2016 was the year of trying to co-opt a party. Because Bernie tried to co-opt the Democratic Party. He wasn't a Democrat. He just wanted to use their mechanism and their voters. He wasn't any better than Trump. He was just on the other side. And we ended up with what we got in 2016 because of the polarization that I think was not created by anything that Obama did, except for get himself elected after being a United States senator for 2 years and having been nothing more than a state senator for a term, and as they attacked him on it being a community organizer, a lawyer. It wasn't his time.
Mm.
It literally wasn't his time. It was Hillary's time. It was her time in 2008. It would have been a fabulous election to have her running and against McCain. But when Obama won, 2016 could be foreseen by anybody because the uptick in activity of white supremacist organizations and the way that evangelicals were preaching. You could see it coming. And we have to understand that that is the root of all of this. I don't want to hear your religious fervor. You're using religion to cover up for what you really are, a white supremacist. And this is the real, this is why we are where we are. And Trump gave license to it.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came out and said, it's okay because you're good people, just like the other side. Even though you carry torches and even though you run people down with cars and even though you shoot up synagogues, it doesn't matter. You're good people. Even if you try to help me with a coup, okay, and overthrow the government, you're good people. We love you. And that's why we are where we are right now. And it's not going to go away even if Biden wins. That movement is going to take years to dissipate, to get those people to climb back in their holes and cover up their heads with the rock they crawled out from under. Okay, that's what it's going to take. It's going to take a great economy where people say, why would I want to get rid of these people? I'm doing really good. I'm not going to do any better than I am now. Okay, yeah, I don't like the fact that, you know, that black people are, you know, outnumbering us and brown people are outnumbering us. I don't care. Okay, as long as I'm doing okay, I got nothing to worry about. But minority rule never works unless there's a strong man at the front of it. And that's a death knell for our Constitution. This vote in Ohio today is a bellwether for what's going to happen in 2024. If, in fact, Democrats have arisen, pro-choice people have arisen and driven Republicans down in this vote and in the vote in November, Ohio's back in play for Democrats.
Right.
As is any other state that passes any of these referendums. And as long as they keep the right to abortion and the right to terminate a pregnancy and a woman's right to control her own body on the ballot or an issue, it's a wiener. There's no question about it. And it may be, as it was in 2022, what decides.
Mm-hmm.
That and whether states that are supposed to change their congressional boundaries, okay, do what they've been told to do. I know Florida's going to follow the Alabama thing. Big middle finger at the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
I know that's what they're going to do because, you know, in every one of those states that something like that is happening, McCarthy's called the governors and said, if you want to sustain the majority, you have to say no. You have to just do what you want to do and make them chase you. You don't have to obey the Supreme Court. I want to be Speaker of the House, so let's rip up the Constitution.
Right.
Okay? So, very important vote going on. Kind of esoteric conversation took place this morning when I was watching Morning Joe, because I do watch Morning Joe, everybody. Hillary Clinton wrote I brought up her name a minute ago.
Yeah.
Hillary Clinton wrote an article for The Atlantic that just came out to this morning. And she entitled it The Weaponization of Loneliness. And she had some really important things to say. There's two things that are going on here. She talked about, in leading up to it, that elections used to be run by local people, Republicans and Democrats, who were all in it together to protect the Constitution and people's rights to vote. Now they can't find people to work at the polls. There's a drastic shortage. if they started paying them people a good wage, people would take the job. But these are all volunteers. And she raises that because people are becoming shut-ins. In particular, disaffected, frightened, lonely males, young males. And she said people like Bannon and Jones recognize this. This is my audience. These people have nothing. They sit at home and play games on their video screens.
Mm-hmm.
They don't go out and socialize. They don't have friends. They don't go to church. They don't go to public interest things. They're not involved in their community. They're not involved in their government. They just are all by themselves. And they're angry. They're angry because their lives are nothing. It's the same thing with them, you know, dealing with the opposite sex. They don't know how to deal with the opposite sex. They don't know how to date. They don't know how to be husbands. They don't know anything. They just sit and play their video games. And they noticed all of this, Bannon and Jones, and said, I'm going to target it and blame your lousy life on everybody else. You're white. You're powerful. You should be out there pushing your power, okay, and getting and radicalizing them. And they created this phenomenon. People like I've just described are very susceptible to radicalizations because they'll go on their computers and people will tell them there's nothing wrong with them. It's the other people that are wrong. You're perfectly okay, and the rejection of you is because they're woke, as DeSantis calls it, or because they want to subjugate white men. One way out of this that was described a number of ways was, for example, public service. Everybody is required to be involved in public service. That makes, teaching civics in a high school, getting people out of the house, whether it be a religious meeting of some sort or joining the military, and get them socializing with people, not sitting in their home being lonely. And when they're exposed to other people, they're exposed to other ideas, and that's how you homogenize in a way your society. So I thought it was a very interesting article. I would recommend it to people. I got a chance to look it over briefly after I saw what they were talking about, and it's in the Atlantic, and I would highly recommend it. Your thoughts,
yeah.
Brendan?
Yeah, I'm really glad she wrote that. I haven't seen it yet. I'm absolutely going to put that on my agenda today to read it. And you and Hezzy are probably getting tired of hearing me say every week, what we really need to do is get some psychologists in here to figure out what's going on in this country.
I'm afraid.
Yeah, I know, right. But you know.
I'm afraid for me.
Too.
Not the finding out things I don't want to know. I'm afraid for me.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. God. No, I'd like to send you to a shrink. You get that report.
Right. Okay, right. It might be funny. You never know.
Yeah. Right. There was off the topic, but what was the I want to see that note again. That birthday party you had where you your kindergarten teacher wrote a note about you to your parents.
No, it was my third grade teacher.
Third grade? Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Thanks. Yeah, that's what I want to examine.
Yeah,
Thank you very much.
That's one of the funniest things I've ever seen, Hezzy, because his third grade teacher had Jeff just totally pegged. What'd she say? Yeah. He's stubborn and talks a lot.
He's evidently quite astute, evidently.
Oh, God.
It was something about the fact that I'm really bright, but I just can't stop socializing and talking.
Yeah, right, right.
basically the note, yeah.
Right.
I'll have to look. I still have that report card.
Yeah, I want to.
And by the way, since she's listening, Marilyn, thank you very much for publicizing that to everybody in the world.
Yeah, that was a very popular display. Yep.
She looked through some stuff that I had in a drawer, stuff that I had saved, and she found my third grade report card. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. That's good. Thank you very much. That's why I said I don't want any psychologists involved.
Yeah, right.
Well, we can get them involved. I just don't want them talking to me.
We'll keep them away from you and ask them the question. Because, you know, we've all seen cults and read about cults and, you know, most of us stand back from afar and just say, how can that happen to people? You know, the things that they can make themselves believe because some cult leader tells them to believe it. It's a hypnosis, you know, a brainwashing. And so we know, I mean, there are very popular stories about, you know, people who commit suicide because they're told to do that by a cult leader. The question though, and what is so amazing to me, because I think it's becoming more and more apparent now that what's left of the Republican Party is actually a cult. It's not a political party anymore. The question is not how do some people get wrapped up in these unbelievable schemes. The question is how does 40% of the most powerful country on the planet get wrapped up in a cult? That's a question, and Hillary Clinton, you know, good for her, is taking a stab at explaining at least a piece of it. But I've also heard others, people are talking more openly about this now, you know, because something in this country has gone very, very wrong. And it does have to do with psychology, and it does have to do with people's feelings and emotions. I've heard people, you know, make similar statements that, you know, the thing is that when you take somebody whose life, you know, and this sounds judgmental and condescending, but I think we have to deal with the reality of it. When you take somebody whose life really is a sad, you know, it's a sad state, somebody who really is what nobody wants. Nobody wants to be a nobody.
Right.
You know, everybody wants
a good way to put it.
Yeah.
That's a very good way to put it. It really is.
Everybody wants
to
feel
important.
Like they're powerful. They're important.
Yeah.
And
when you hand them that power, okay, they will abuse it.
Right. Right.
Oh, by the way, Marilyn popped her head in.
Yeah.
And brought me exactly what was said on my report card.
Okay.
Jeffrey is very enthusiastic about school and keenly interested in all of our activities. He has made good progress in reading. Although he has shown some improvement, he still talks out of turn too much. If he would use a little more self-control, he could do above grade level work.
Yeah, right.
All I can say is that is this kind of way of saying he should shut up. Possibly say it. Okay,
right.
I mean, that is so diplomatic. Thank you very much for your input. Go away. What's interesting is that in all of this that we're talking about, Meryl and I were having a very kind of deep conversation about the apocalypse and how she's starting to believe that this may be the end of days that we are seeing right now. She says we have pestilence everywhere. We have natural disasters happening that out of place and the earth is starting to burn up, okay? And it may very well be that the evangelicals who laid hands on him truly believe that Trump is the Antichrist, which is supposed to bring about the end of days, the battle between heaven and hell, and the end of the earth as we know it, and the resurrection. Either if you're Jewish, you come back, or if you are a Christian, Jesus will come back and he will make all Christians rise up, okay? And said this very well may be the apocalypse. Now, I'm not going that far, okay? But I will say that I watch a lot of Supernatural, and I gotta tell you, this is fitting right in, okay, with Revelations, okay? I don't know. You know, we're destroying the earth, and there's disease, and there's pestilence, and there's war. I can't remember what the other horseman of the four was, okay?
Right, right.
But you know, when you think about it, you know, maybe Bob Robert Singer, who wrote the show, was right. Maybe, you know, this is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's the end of days. Time to go to church. Maybe I should convert. I don't know. Okay, so, but I want to thank you, Marilyn, for bringing me my report card. All right.
Yeah,
rings,
absolutely.
Rings, like, okay. And thank you for mentioning it, Brendan.
Yeah.
Another thing that happened over the past weekend, which is really very interesting, is Elena Kagan appeared at the Ninth Circuit match. She
I think we just lost Jeffrey.
The judges show up. What?
Okay.
You cut out there for a minute.
So we just missed whatever you said originally. We lost. I don't know why.
Oh, okay. All right. It was a meeting of the Ninth Circuit conference, and all of the judges, no matter what level they may be, from circuit all the way down to bankruptcy judge and magistrates, all get together. And she was going through one of those things where she didn't want to give a speech, so they put you on stage with a moderator who asks you a lot of questions in front of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually took on Sam Alito almost directly for his two op-eds, basically saying that SCOTUS doesn't need new ethics. We're doing fine right now. Congress should mind their own business. And by the way, they don't have the power to tell us what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And her response in one four-word or three-word sentence, we're not imperial, meaning the court. We're not imperial. We are not infallible. And basically made the position that she endorsed it will take Congress to establish ethical standards for SCOTUS and all of the justices that work there. She refused to accept that SCOTUS is the only institution in our government, okay, that is unchecked. Everybody else has checks and balances, but the Supreme Court doesn't need one or doesn't have one. And his argument was that Congress created the Supreme Court. And not Congress, I mean the founders and the Constitution created the Supreme Court, and so as a result it gave no power of any of the other branches to have any kind of check or balance on them. Well, the Constitution created the check and balances but didn't really give those other parts, those other two branches, the power to do it. They just assumed that power.
Mm-hmm.
The only check and balance that's in the Constitution is the ability of the president to veto what Congress does and the ability of Congress to override that veto. It gave Congress the power of the purse, but it gave the executive the power to not spend the money they're given. That's it. That's all that's there. the Supreme Court created themselves as being a check and a balance. There's always been questions as to whether they really meant for the Supreme Court to do anything more than they were authorized to do, and that is decide disputes between the states. They gave themselves that power in Marbury versus Madison. They didn't have it in the Constitution. So if that's the case, you're out of business. Alito, we don't need you anymore. So I have some real problems with the thought process, like she does, that they're unchecked. We know that Congress in the Constitution is given the power to create the courts that are under SCOTUS. We give SCOTUS the ability to supervise them by statute. But those courts are created by Congress, mm-hmm. and they answer to Congress, whether it's for money, whether it's their rules, whether it's how many of them that sit, how they created the districts and the circuits, are all done by statute by Congress. So what makes SCOTUS different? She was trying to answer in doing this the problems that have been created by Alito and Thomas and Gorsuch and Roberts and their failures and the connections to far-right mega donors.
Mm-hmm.
She was hypercritical of that, and she accused those six people who are on the right side of the court, and I don't mean correct, I mean right as in position, of pursuing policy prerogatives over theirs and in spite of their textualist claims. They abandoned those textualist claims. The only person who's a true textualist on that court right now, Ketanji Jackson, because she thinks the 14th Amendment was a founding provision in the Constitution, and that it made all of the Constitution applicable to all of the states and gave Congress the power to pass laws that Congress, that other states have to follow.
Mm-hmm.
That's what she says. And she says, I am a textualist. They are not.
Mm-hmm.
She was so good at it that she convinced Gorsuch to go with her in the affirmative action case and adopt her opinion and her reasoning. So she was very outspoken, but not directly addressing herself to certain people, but addressing their the things that they had done wrong so they were easily identifiable. I think people should read it so that you could really understand what she did here.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting article. I don't remember where I found it, but I found it written by a guy named Jeff Overly. You don't even have to read it. You can listen to it. If you find the article, you can listen to it. They'll read it to you. But she was deadly serious. And she said, of course Congress can regulate various aspects of what the Supreme Court does.
Yeah.
They can't do everything they want, but that is something they can do.
Right.
So you see another schism in the court. And she understands that the court's in big trouble. People
yeah.
should, when 28% of the people hold the Supreme Court in high regard, we are in trouble. So,
right.
I'm done with that. Right. If you want to comment.
Yeah. First of all, I certainly agree with your last point. The only thing Congress can't do is tell the court how to decide cases. you know, that's obvious. That's the judicial function. The notion that Congress has, Alito's notion that Congress, you know, has to stay totally hands off because we're the Supreme Court and we make our own rules, is bogus. You know, and I think a couple of questions would address why. So Here, you know, if I had Sam Alito sitting here, I'd say, do you agree that the Constitution gives or the Constitution provides for the impeachment and removal of a federal judge, including a justice of the Supreme Court? And, of course, his answer, if he's going to be honest, would be yes. It says it right at the, right there. In mm-hmm. the Constitution, judges can be impeached and removed. All right. Now, next question, Justice Alito. Which branch gets to do that? Which branch gets to decide whether to impeach and remove a justice of the Supreme Court? Well, that I think would be the legislature the last time I checked, Jeff. Am I wrong on that? I think that's Congress.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is.
Right.
Since I have a friend right. who was an impeached judge. He's dead now, but
okay.
I had a friend right. who was an impeached judge.
Yeah, yeah. So, and it looks like Congress did that, right? So,
yeah, they actually did, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, so what Alito is arguing is that the same branch that's empowered to decide how and when to remove a U.S. Supreme Court justice has no say in what constitutes ethical behavior for a Supreme Court justice. I would submit that is absurd on its face. But you know, who am I, right? Nobody put me on the Supreme Court. So,
well,
so,
that's much to our detriment that never happened.
What's that? You're cutting out there a little bit.
I said it's much to our detriment that never happened.
Yeah. Yes. I have to agree with that. Yeah. Sure. They should put us both on the Supreme Court. That would be fun. Yeah.
Yes.
Somebody write a letter to Joe Biden and tell him to get on that. Okay. Yeah.
No, I don't think they let me on the Supreme Court because, you know, every judge thinks that they're, you know, they can take their act on the road.
Yeah.
But everything they say is funny.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine had a placard on the back of her nameplate that said, "You think it's funny. They don't."
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Okay. So, no, I don't think Supreme Court's a place where I should be under any circumstances. Okay. What can I tell you? There is one other thing that the Supreme Court has to do, and I didn't talk about this with you. I was originally against this. I've never liked cameras in a courtroom.
Yeah, right.
But I think back, and I don't even know if you were alive during Watergate.
Yeah, I was.
I was in law school.
Mm-hmm.
When Watergate was happening. And in truth, the country, for other reasons, was as divided in 1973 and 74 as we are now. All of this over Richard Nixon and the Watergate burglary and things that happened afterwards. And just like Trump says, everything he did is stood up there and said, "I am not a crook."
Mm.
It really happened and suspected that there was a big cover-up, all those kinds of things. And Republicans in the Senate and Republicans in the House were supporting Nixon and said it was a witch hunt. And they just wanted to get – they were just after Nixon and because they didn't like him. All the things that
Here we lost him again. He keeps cutting in and out.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what's causing that. There's probably something wrong with the internet and with the phones. Yeah, it looks like we just lost Jeffrey. Okay, well, it looks like we lost Jeffrey and Brendan and Jeffrey were in a conference call. So we lost them both. Okay, there's probably Jeffrey again.
I'm back.
See.
I'm back.
Okay.
I'm back.
Somehow we lost you. Yep, I hear you.
Yeah.
And then I guess Brendan is going to call you
because I conference him in, we lost. Brendan will call in.
Yeah.
He'll call back. Okay. Where did you lose
goodness.
Me? Because I was talking about Watergate. Long time?
Oh, that's when we lost you. We'll talk about Watergate.
Okay. I didn't get far into it with you then. Did I get to the point of talking about... Okay. So let's start over on that.
Okay.
In 1973 and 74, we were as divided as we are today. Republicans versus Democrats. It didn't carry the kind of connotation it has now and the violence that went with it, but we were very divided. Republicans were calling the investigation into Watergate a witch hunt, and Democrats were just after Nixon and trying to get to Nixon. They fought all these investigations that went into them, and then all of a sudden we had the Watergate Select Committee where Sam Ervin was the senator who headed it all up. And Howard Baker and others were still fighting. Some of the witnesses, there's nothing directly involving the president. Nobody's saying that. And then Dean, you know, the former White House counselor, John Dean, walked in and gave his testimony. And they still questioned it. But then walked in a guy named Butterfield, who told us about that there was a recording system in the Oval Office. And despite his attempts to hold those tapes back, Nixon trying to hold back those tapes and going to the Supreme Court and everything else, we got the tapes, and the tapes came out. And then Haldeman testified, and Ehrlichman testified. And people started to realize and educated themselves through watching these committee meetings. And by doing that, they became educated and understood what was going on. And sentiment started to change. Nixon had a 60% approval rating, and even in the 50s, pending all of the until the tapes came out, and then it started to plummet. At some point, Howard Baker and Barry Goldwater walked down to the White House and said, "You're going to be impeached, sir. You're going to be convicted. You have to resign." And it happened. And the country was united in the idea that Richard Nixon did things that were illegal, did things that were unconstitutional, and had to go. We were united in that. Well, we became united through education. I have become convinced now that the trial of Donald Trump in Washington, D.C., and the trial of Donald Trump in Fort Pierce, Florida, must be televised, despite the regulations against televised trials and meetings of any court in the federal system under Rule 73. John Roberts has got to say, no, this must be televised. The people of the United States have to hear the witnesses themselves. They have to see the exhibits themselves. They have to, if Donald Trump takes a stand, watch him testify himself and be cross-examined. And then listen to the rebuttal testimony. The people of the United States have to see this. No matter what the jury decides, they have to decide for themselves. People have to learn that this is not made up. This is not Democrats going after Donald Trump. Every single witness is going to testify for the government, at least with outside of FBI people or other people that took reports and interviewed people. The people themselves who give the testimony are all going to be Republicans. They are all going to be people that surrounded Donald Trump. They were all Trump loyalists, and some of them are still loyalists to this day, but will tell the truth, and you will hear and see what really happened. And it will educate people and maybe break the spell on some people. This trial must be televised in its entirety, gavel to gavel. Did Brendan come back?
Not Hello? Yet, so I thought he was connected with you.
Didn't connect through me. So I figured he would call back, but apparently didn't. So he can't
okay.
get through. That's why he connected through me. So, but he never called me back. So
okay.
We lost him for today. We lost him for today.
It seems
but,
like it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Seems like it.
Yeah. So I'm firmly convinced, and it took a lot to get there, that Donald Trump must have a public trial. And I don't mean public because there's a few people from the general public that get in there and the rest of it's media and everybody's spinning what's said and everybody's deciding what was said. Let the American people hear for themselves. Let's record it. Let's play back testimony when people start talking about this and let the public see it for themselves. And then.
Yep.
Maybe then, as I said before, the spell will be broken. And if, and I believe it's more of a when, he gets convicted, he must go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
Not live in the lap of luxury at Mar-a-Lago under home confinement. He must go to jail. He must serve his time. And I understand, for all intents and purposes, it would be a life sentence for him. He's 78 years old.
Yeah.
But the lesson has to be learned because we're in this fix because Richard Nixon didn't go to jail. He wasn't tried. He wasn't convicted. Gerald Ford says he did it to heal the country. He did it because the deal was Nixon made was if I resign, I get pardoned. That was the deal. And Ford lived
up. Most people didn't know that. Most people didn't know that.
That they were told there was no deal. There was a deal.
Yeah.
Okay. There was a deal. And Jerry Ford really never thought he was going to run for re-election, although he did. And got beat by Carter. The truth of the matter is that he should not have pardoned Nixon. And if Nixon had been convicted and punished, I guarantee you we would not be as divided today over Donald Trump. In fact, Donald Trump wouldn't have gotten away with anything that he did. He would have been impeached, and Republicans would have voted to throw him out. But I don't think he would have existed. So and Marilyn will tell you, I fought cameras in the courtroom. That's just the way it is. They distract people, blah, 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 blah. Well, it's yada, yada, yada now, I'm saying to myself. It has to happen. So we got a couple minute or two left, I guess.
Yeah.
We were going to talk about Aileen Luce Cannon, who on her own sent out an order ordering Trump's lawyers to address an issue that they didn't even raise about the fact that attacking the idea that two grand juries were used to indict Trump in South Florida. There's absolutely no case law to support there's anything wrong with that. And she was with the U.S. Attorney's Office, and she knows there's nothing wrong with it. But it will stall things off a little bit longer. She is bound and intent not to try that case. She wants it to go away. She's going to give Trump everything he wants. And at this point, if I'm Jack Smith, it's time to go with a motion to disqualify her, basically saying what I said to a judge once. I said to a judge once, I want to remind you, Judge Rothenberg, that Mr. Rank is trying the case for the state of Florida, not you. She didn't like that. It's time to tell Aileen Cannon that Mr. Trump has his own lawyers. He doesn't need you to do lawyering for him. You need to get off this case. And then if she doesn't do it, take her to the 11th Circuit and let them spank her. She's really gone way, way too far, creating issues that don't exist. And it isn't for the betterment and protecting of the rights of Donald Trump, it is to create more issues that even Trump's lawyers hadn't even raised, because they know it's spurious. The men sets off a hearing on a motion to disqualify Nauta's lawyer for representing some of the witnesses against him for a conflict of interest. Of course that's a conflict of interest. Every lawyer knows it's a conflict of interest, but she's going to have a hearing on it in 2 weeks, more excludable time. So she's giving Donald everything. She is Donald's judge in his pocket. She is lawyering for him, and she needs to get off the case. And if you're listening to me, Judge Cannon, I'm still waiting for the letter. If you think I'm wrong, call me into court and tell me so, and I'll tell you why I'm not wrong. We were going to talk about the new order that just came out on the Washington case, but we didn't really get a decision on that, and so she said that off for a hearing on Friday. I think Donald's going to be real unhappy after that hearing's over, but I think she's going to be laying down the law on Friday, so we'll see. It's 11 o'clock.
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Big Hand is on the 12, so it's time for us. I'm sorry we lost Brendan. He's got a circuit problem. That's why we brought him in the other way earlier. Mm-hmm. So, Hezzy, take care of yourself.
Thank you. And you take care of yourself as well.
Okay.
And my
everybody,
best friend,
we'll be back again next week.
Thank you. Be well.
We'll be back next week again from the friendly confines of my rented house on the first screen. Okay?
Okay.
I'll see you next week.
Take care.
Take care, buddy.
All
okay?
the best.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye. There we have it. None other than, Brendan Byrne. Brendan Beery is not there at the moment, but just terrific, to hear Professor Jeffrey Swartz as well. That's a great ending. Well, there's so much that's going on. It's really fascinating. I can't imagine anyone who's hiding out from what's going on, but I think it's a very pertinent concept, and it's going to be very, very instrumental in defining what happened if everything gets broadcast live and repeated over and over again until everyone has an opportunity to see it, because it's so pertinent. Well, okay. Just see what else is going on here. I hope we're still connected. So let's go over a couple of things which you may find interesting. Bear with me a moment here. Just see if I can get this done. Okay. Well, evidently the eastern United States has been hit by deadly storms and major power outages. Excuse me. At least two people have died in storms that battered the eastern United States, with flights canceled and many left without power. Millions were under severe weather alerts, including tornado watches. Rain, hail, strong winds swept almost the entire eastern seaboard of the United States on Monday, with at least two people killed during the severe weather. And the storms also caused power outages for hundreds of thousands of people and led to the cancellation of thousands of flights across the region. The weather alerts were issued throughout the affected area, which extended from the state of Alabama in the south to that of New York in the north. A 28-year-old man in Alabama died after being struck by lightning in a car park, and a 15-year-old boy in South Carolina was killed by a fallen tree as he visited his grandparents. That's what local media had reported. So in the mid-Atlantic state of Virginia, hailstorms as large as 4.5 inches in diameter were recorded, according to the U.S. government's National Weather Service. And by late Monday, more than 1.1 million customers were affected by power outages along the East Coast across Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Maryland, Delaware, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, West Virginia, and Virginia, according to the tracking website Power Outage US. Well, more than 1,700 flights were canceled, more than 8,000 delayed, website FlightAware had said. The NWS had said, the National Weather Service had said that more than 29.5 million people were under a tornado watch on Monday in the afternoon, including in the capital of Washington, D.C., and the surrounding region. As the East was struck by the storms, residents of southern U.S. states, including Texas, Louisiana, and Florida, were receiving excessive heat warnings. There were temperatures of up to 108 degrees Fahrenheit, which had been forecast on Tuesday. The intensity and frequency of extreme weather events across the world is increasing under the influence of climate change, largely caused by the burning of fossil fuels, so scientists had said. So really, really frightening. Now, this is really quite interesting. With regard to Ecuador, could oil drilling in the Amazon rainforest end? Seems that Ecuadorians will vote in a referendum later in August on whether to continue oil and gold mining projects in the Amazon rainforest. And here's a look at what's at stake. So heads of governments in the Amazon region are meeting to discuss how to protect the crucial rainforest. Illegal deforestation has marred the region for years, and scientists fear it could be reaching a tipping point. It seems that the Amazon rainforest is one of the world's most important carbon sinks and absorbs massive amounts of carbon dioxide released by burning fossil fuels. Yet it remains under threat. Around 17% of the forest has already been destroyed. Leaders of eight Amazon rainforest countries will meet this week in the northern Brazilian city of Belém for a summit to discuss ways to protect the crucial carbon sink, as well as sustainable developments in the region and the role of indigenous peoples in, among other things, protecting the forest. The world needs to help us preserve and develop the Amazon, so said Brazilian President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who told journalists last week ahead of the Amazon Cooperation Treaty Organization, ACTO, meeting. The country contains around 60% of the forest. Well, there's a new leader and a new hope. Lula da Silva, president of Brazil in January of this year, and under his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro, vast tracts of the Amazon fell to make way for mining, cattle ranches, and soybean farming. In 2022 alone, the last year of Bolsonaro's leadership, almost 5 million acres of forest was lost. And during his tenure, from 2019 to 2022, Bolsonaro's administration weakened regulation and enforcement around deforestation, shrinking the budgets of agencies monitoring environmental crimes and pushing for laws allowing forest-destroying mining on indigenous land. It took a toll, and deforestation in Brazil in 2015 accounted for just a quarter of global tree cover loss in tropical primary forests, which are some of the oldest and most untouched forests in the world. And that figure grew to 43% in 2022, according to the recent Global Forest Watch, GFW report, published by research organization World Resources Institute, the WRI. But since Lula da Silva took office, deforestation in Brazil's Amazon to be slowing. Official figures show a drop of 33.6% from January to June compared to the same period in 2022. Lula da Silva wants to go further and has promised to halt illegal deforestation completely in the Amazon by 2030. It's an ambitious goal that requires cooperation between states, say experts like Mercedes Bustamante, a professor specializing in land use and environmental change at the University of Brasilia. Well, Bustamante sees the summit as essential for tackling some of the biggest threats to the forest. Quote, most activities that are now related to deforestation in the Amazon region are connected to organized crime, and organized crime doesn't know borders, she told Deutsche Welle. So we really need integrated action between the countries in the Amazon basin so that we can track these illegal activities and make it more efficient and more effective. A tropical forest deforestation trend. It seems that last year, Brazil was the country with by far the highest rate of tree loss in the world. Democratic Republic of Congo and Bolivia trailed a distant second and third, but deforestation remains a big problem globally. In 2022, tree cover loss in tropical primary forests rose 10% on last year to 4.1 million hectares. That's the equivalent of 11 football stadiums of forest per minute, according to the GFW report. It's having a devastating effect on the climate. So where the most tropical forests lost in 2022? As a share of global tropical forest lost in percent, Brazil lost 43.1%, Democratic Republic of Congo 12.6%, Bolivia 9.4%, Indonesia 5.6%, Peru 3.9%, Colombia 3.1%, Laos 2.3%, Cameroon 1.9%, Papua New Guinea 1.8%, Malaysia 1.7%, and all others 14.6%. It seems that forests are carbon sinks, absorbing around as much, twice as much carbon dioxide as they emit every year. The tropical forests in particular are essential to reaching climate targets or more carbon dioxide from the atmosphere than other types of wooded regions. As they are destroyed, they release much of the carbon they have captured back into the air. The forest loss in the tropics alone in 2022 produced 2.7 gigatons of carbon dioxide emissions, equivalent to the fossil fuel emissions emitted by the world's most populous country, India, according to WRI's GFW report. There is a rampant deforestation as a legacy of Bolsonaro's term. Nowhere has that been more of a problem than in Brazil. Primary forest loss in the country rose 15% between 2021 and 2022. And that means forests in the country are storing less carbon dioxide. Scientists fear continuing loss could eventually, quote, lead to a tipping point, end quote, beyond which the majority of the ecosystem will become a savanna, wrote the GFW report authors. Still, the newest figures showing a fall of deforestation coupled with a strengthening of IBAMA, the agency that enforces environmental laws in the Amazon, are promising signs. Quote, we already saw in the first 3 months an increase in the number of fines for environmental crimes that IBAMA issues, end quote, Katarina Yakovac, a biologist at Brazil's Federal University of Santa Catarina, advised Deutsche Welle. That's an indication that now IBAMA is again on the ground and really fighting deforestation. We are seeing these changes, and I hope we will see results soon. Well, battling deforestation in the Amazon, Lula da Silva's race against time. Team Lula da Silva has a history of success with reducing tree felling in the Amazon. And during his first 2 years as president. Between 2003 and 2010, deforestation rates in the rainforest dropped 80% before rising again in 2012, according to INPE, Brazil's National Institute for Space Research. An explanation of protected areas, designation of indigenous regions, and monitoring of the forest were among some of the grievances, measures implemented during his first administration. Lula da Silva's new government is now building on the past experience, said Paulo Masoca, a Brazilian environmental scientist and postdoctorate at the Indiana University in Bloomington. But Lula's government has resumed the process of designating and demarcating protected areas in indigenous lands, recognizing that the importance of these actions to also protect the environment and recognize the rights of the people and the importance of people living in the region. So these are the kinds of measures that could be brought beyond Brazil as part of solutions presented at the summit this week. Finding paths of development for countries in the region is also likely to be important. Bustamante said there are opposing views on what role the Amazon plays in this regard, with some traditional quote-unquote lawmakers eschewing conservation in favor of development. Indigenous groups and civil societies, on the other hand, say protecting the rainforest is crucial to development and for development. So I think that is more a question of how this political side will play a role in the summit, she said. Brazil faces the biggest challenge. Bustamante said that reaching the Amazon zero deforestation target and saving one of the world's tools for combating climate change will take a concerted effort and financial investment from the international community. Quote, we would not doubt that the Amazonian countries are responsible for the Amazon region, but they also need global support. So developed countries really have to seriously take the commitment to preserve the Amazon and the global state of the climate as well, she said. So just so you know, this article was published on June 27, 2023, was updated on August 8 for the Amazon Summit in Belém, Brazil. It was edited by Jennifer Collins. So, unbelievable. One second here. Okay. Now let me quickly look and see some other issues. There would be a second here. One moment. Okay, to see if we have all this in place. This is very interesting. Evidently, African women are the World's Cup biggest winners. No African side progressed past the round of 16 at the World Cup, but the teams have underlined the growth of women's football on the continent despite resistance at home and from federations. When the World Cup groups were drawn, a typical malaise set in around the hopes of the African sides at the tournament. All four of the teams had such low FIFA, FIFA World Rankings. Nigeria was 40, South Africa 54, Morocco 72, and Zambia 77. That they were each drawn into groups beset with European and North American powerhouses. Further obstacles were laid in front of the players from all four countries as fights with their federations over equal pay, treatment, and in Zambia's case, accusations of sexual abuse from their head coach, Bruce Mwape, blighted their build-up to the tournament. Yet on the field, African players showed themselves to be athletes possessing immense talent, skill, and in many cases, untapped potential. Morocco women's place is anywhere but the kitchen. Go back to your kitchen was a cry far too often familiar to the 23-strong Moroccan squad that traveled to Australia and New Zealand, for instance. Despite the historic World Cup run, the Arab countries saw its men's side enjoy in Qatar. The same enthusiasm for the women's team just 7 months later was sorely lacking. It was a notable discord, given the support the women's side had received when the hosts reached the Women's Africa Cup of Nations, WAFCON, back in 2022. But the Atlas Lionesses put all the noise from home aside to ensure their own slice of history was just as impressive and visible in the world stage. After their first ever World Cup, they achieved major milestones, winning their maiden match, seeing Anu Haile Benzema become the first player to take the field at the tournament wearing a hijab, and advancing to the knockout stages at the expense of Germany with a 1-0 victory over Colombia. Following the win, Knorr, a bouillon company and a staple of the Moroccan kitchen, ran an advertisement with a picture of the World Cup trophy and a message that read, quote, "Nothing other than Knorr knows belongs in the kitchen. Congratulations to the Lionesses of the Atlas." Benzema, too, offered yet more recognition for athletes and young girls who wear hijabs, as the 25-year-old was recently added to the world's largest football video game, EA's FIFA 23. A lot of people put a lot of disrespect on African nations. Seems the expectations for and around Nigeria were heightened, given the Super Falcons have played in all 9 editions of the Women's World Cup. Their lead-up to the competition was ruined when their training camp in Nigeria was canceled, and uncertainty reigned over whether they would be paid, with allegations that they had failed to be remunerated for 2 years. With FIFA having announced that each player reaching the round of 16 would receive a minimum of $50,000 toward Uchenna Kanu, forward Uchenna Kanu admitted to Deutsche Welle that she was unsure if the Nigeria Football Federation, the NFA, would pass the money on to the players. Although their off-field battles remained a topic of discussion throughout the tournament, the team produced some of the best attacking football of the group stages, as their quick counter-attacks and bravery helped them beat host Australia. Their own round of 16 demise against European champions England on penalties was harsh, given the African side had shaded the majority of the 120 minutes of open play. But for defender Ashley Pumptier, the team's play finally showed the world that African sides are capable of more than just using their strength, quote-unquote. "I feel like a lot of people put a lot of disrespect on African nations," he explained to Deutsche Welle. "They say they're just physical or they're just fast, but you can see we have incredibly technical players too. I think now more people need to be talking about what we do as an overall football nation. Quote, we're not just like a kick and run, and people do make those kinds of assumptions. It's nice that all African teams at this tournament have showcased what they're all about." Well, the domestic South African lead deserves immediate investment. South Africa, too, had a moment of reckoning. Lacking World Cup contracts, a resolution didn't come to Banyana, as the side is known, until billionaire Patrice Motsepe, owner of the South African professional team,
Mamelodi Sundowns and president of the Confederation of African Football, intervened and made a $320,000 donation to the team. The audacity of asking for recompense did not go down well with many in South Africa, and after the team let a two-goal lead slip during their group match against Argentina, that they were bombarded thereby on social media. However, a sensational last-minute winner from stand-in captain and winning goal scorer Thembi Kgatlana propelled South Africa to the knockout stages. We've had a lot of criticism, Kgatlana had said. I've lost three family members in the last 2 weeks, and I could have gone home, but this was too important. Even though the team departed at the round of 16 after losing to the Netherlands, head coach Desiree Ellis issued the following rallying cry, quote, "Sponsors, I don't know how you can ignore something special like this," end quote. Continuing, "I don't know how you can't assist in getting us to climb the ladder. We still have players who have a 9-to-5 job and then go to train in the evening. That's unacceptable." Well, cross-country support is key for African nations. For Zambia, there was no fairy tale ending, but they did secure their first ever World Cup victory when they swatted aside Costa Rica in their final group match in Hamilton. On the eve of the tournament, reports emerged that coach Bruce Mwape had been under investigation by FIFA over sexual abuse claims from his players, and a further allegation was lodged at the end of the group stage claiming the head coach had inappropriately touched one of his players during the tournament. Fans from various African countries traveled to both Hamilton and Auckland to support the Zambian side, but were dismayed upon learning of the accusations. But supporters in the stands, like Joyce, said they felt it all the more important to be vocal and vibrant in their encouragement for the players in light of such allegations. "The girls should know we are here to cheer for them," the Zimbabwean-born Chitepo had advised Deutsche Welle, quote, "They have the support of all of Africa, like every team does. We're stronger than when we support each other." So that was the story. Unbelievable. But it is just a reality. Now let's look at some other issues. Bear with me a moment. This is really quite interesting. Evidently, Sweden's Quran burnings put into question how the Kremlin benefits from it. The Swedish government is dealing with increased terrorist threats sparked by repeated Quran burnings. Now, Russia appears to be instrumentalizing the issue. Hussam El-Homati scrolls through his phone and points at a long list in Arabic. Muhammad Ahmad Ali, the most typical name with some funny picture, he notes, scrolling through the post. El-Homati confirms what he expected, quote, "Yeah, you're going to find that he is also liking the Ukrainian-Russian war and commenting a lot about it, like so many profiles, countless profiles." He pulls a photo of another account, one of Russian President Vladimir Putin kissing a Quran in an event where the Russian leader also criticizes countries he said do not protect Islam's holy book, meaning, of course, Sweden. "This profile," says the picture, "shows everything. This is why we Muslims are with Moscow," El-Homato translates. "This kind of message has an echo, so it is effective and it is dangerous, and we need to make a stop on this. Well, a Libyan-born political activist now working as an investor in Stockholm, El-Homati believes the Swedish government should stop issuing permits for public demonstrations to anyone who may deserve religious books or desecrate religious books. A non-practicing Muslim, he personally attends Quran burnings to discuss the issue with those gathered in an attempt to reduce tempers on all sides. Okay, bear with me a moment here. Okay. So the Swedish government analysts are also sounding the alarm. Quote, we have seen for the first time Russia using the narratives, focusing on the false image of Sweden being hostile against Islam, says Mikael Ostlund of the University or the Agency for Psychological Defense, a Swedish defense ministry's office tasked with detecting and combating dangerous propaganda. Quote, they are repeating the narratives that we see in the Islamist extremist environment and using that in their state-controlled media channels like Russia Today and Sputnik toward the Arabic-speaking people, he says. While disinformation coming from Moscow wouldn't normally get much traction among Swedes, Ostlund advised Deutsche Welle that messages are being spread through the global South, Latin America, Africa and Asia, and then even recirculated back to Sweden in a manner that disguises their origin as Russian propaganda. It's happened before, Ostlund had said, when Kremlin-controlled outlets created a rumor that Swedish social services were systematically kidnapping and trying to Christianize children from Muslim families, which make up an estimated 8% of the population, according to a 2016 survey by the Pew Research Center. That was the largest disinformation campaign, malign campaign toward Sweden ever, Ostlund had explained, reaching hundreds of millions of followers on social media. It's a threat to society, a united society. If people don't believe that they can get help from public authorities, he noted, and I believe the truth will win the long run when they have free debate, but we don't have a free debate, Ostlund pointed out. Islam extremists use the truth and make it a lie to spread their agenda among people. The Swedish government has come to the conclusion that public safety is at risk from the anti-Islamic events, and last week it approved expanded police powers for conducting controls at the country's borders in an attempt to keep out anyone who may seek revenge on Sweden. And it's expected the government will soon give police wider scope to reject requests for public meetings, quote-unquote, where religious symbols may be desecrated. The mere fact that we perceive an increased security threat as a result of the Quran burnings is enough for us to make these decisions. The Swedish Foreign Minister Tobias Billström advised Deutsche Welle in Stockholm after the government's announcement, and Billström has been working for months to dispel what he describes as one of the big misunderstandings about Swedish law. Police actively allow the burning of holy books rather than merely granting permission to hold demonstrations. I'm going to continue to explain this, Billström had said, because we have to get rid of this misunderstanding of how our legislation is actually working. It seems that the Swedish government has repeatedly expressed its disapproval of the desecration, but Turkey continues to mention it in its still unfinished process of approving Swedish accession to NATO, and some countries have declined to send ambassadors to Stockholm over the matter. The government got a brief respite last week when one anti-Islam activist suddenly withdrew his request for permission to hold a public meeting where it was expected he would again burn a Quran. Iran refugee Sarwan Momika had previously not only caused chaos in downtown Stockholm, but also provoked severe violence against Swedish interests abroad. As a result of his action, Iraqis set fire to the Swedish embassy in Baghdad last month, and the Iraqi government expelled the Swedish ambassador, even suspending the right for Swedish telecommunications giant Ericsson to do business in Iraq. Instead of any large-scale event that day on a desolate beach, a lone woman staged a tiny anti-Islam protest with no one present but a handful of police officers, a couple of journalists, and Hussam El-Komati in attendance. Got into a bit of a shouting match with her about why she felt the need to burn a Quran. And speaking to Deutsche Welle at the scene, El-Homati explained he was, quote, telling her what you are doing now is hate speech. It's not free speech. A recent poll commissioned by Swedish public broadcaster SVT shows a majority of its citizens may be ready to compromise on their traditional broad interpretation of freedom of expression, with 53% of the population saying it should be illegal to burn any religious text. Well, that would make sense. So hopefully they will get there. Okay, now let me just see some other issues which you may find interesting. Bear with me a moment here. Well, several have been killed in a Russian missile strike on eastern Ukrainian city, the governor says. Two Russian missiles struck the center of Ukraine's Pokrovsk on Monday night, killing at least 7 people, including civilians and first responders, the regional governor said. The missiles launched 40 minutes apart, damaged residential buildings, a hotel, catering establishments, shops, and administrative buildings, the governor added. And you could follow what's going on by simply just looking up stuff on Ukraine on your internet. So it seems that President Volodymyr Zelensky said in a video published on Tuesday that Ukraine would fight back against Russia in the Black Sea to ensure its waters were not blockaded and it could import and export grain and other goods. Comments published on the president's website comes days after Ukraine maritime drones packed with explosives damaged a Russian warship near a major Russian port and struck a Russian tanker. If Russia continues to dominate the Black Sea outside its territory, blockading or firing at us again, launching missiles at our ports, Ukraine will do the same. This is a just defense of our opportunities of any corridor, Zelensky had said. We don't have that many ships, but they should clearly understand that by the end of the war, they will have zero ships, zero, end quote. Well, Russia withdrew from a deal last month allowing the safe export of grains from Ukrainian ports. Russian drones and missiles have reportedly struck Ukrainian port facilities and grain silos. Russia withdrew from the deal last month allowing a safe export of grain from Ukrainian ports. Russian drones and missiles have repeatedly struck Ukrainian port facilities and grain silos. Ukraine has responded by launching sea drone attacks on a Russian oil tanker and a Russian warship at the Novorossiysk naval base next door to a major grain and oil port. Okay. So I think that's about it. Well, the Georgian Prime Minister, Irakli Garibashvili, branded Russia an aggressor, quote-unquote, on Tuesday as he marked 15 years since the two countries fought a war over a breakaway region. We have known for a long time that Russia was an aggressor. We know that, and the whole world knows that, Garibashvili advised reporters. Russia sent hundreds of thousands of troops from Georgia on August 8 of 2008 after Tbilisi launched a large-scale military operation against South Ossetian separatists who had been shelling Georgian villages in the region. Hundreds of soldiers and civilians from both sides were killed during the 2028 war. The United Nations said around 120,000 people were displaced, though many returned to their homes afterwards. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Monday that Kyiv stood to define. One second.